I'm glad we have this new setup where we can see both sides, but the people at the dais look like little teeny people to me, and I can't see anybody. I can see somebody waving right now, and that's great, but I can't see anything more detailed than that.
Yeah, I don't know if there's a way to zoom in, but oh, there we go.
That's better, a little better anyway. Okay. Here, I'm going to hide my own self because I don't really need to look at myself here. What does this mean? Take, oh, okay.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Oregon Retirement Savings Quarterly Board Meeting. It is May 20th, 2025. Treasurer Steiner, over to you.
Thank you so much, Ashley. Good afternoon. I am officially opening remotely a meeting of the Oregon Retirement Savings Board, and thank you all for being here. Today is the first day of what I hope will be a new and perhaps more slightly more engaging format that we're starting to move toward. My experience with boards and commissions, and I suspect the other members will agree with this, is that it's much more interesting when we can engage in more robust conversation. And so our goal is to keep these meetings a little tighter, to provide materials ahead of time to encourage people to look at them, and then shorten the presentation times a little bit in here so that we have more time for conversation about what we're seeing and questions that we hope to have answered by the board. Today will be sort of hybrid. We haven't sent any questions ahead of time for board members to consider. And obviously, we'll need to go over this again at our next meeting when we have more members of the board here. But just want to give you all a heads up that we're trying to move in this direction for both retirement savings and the 529 board meeting boards as well. So with that, I think the only voting members here today are me and Ms. Backus and Ms. Damonen. Am I correct about that? Mr. Mann, you're not technically a voting member, are you?
That's correct. And you have
Okay.
attendance right.
Great. Okay. So we will just move then into the approval of the minutes from the February 18th of May meeting. Do you have a motion for that? Or do I need a motion? Did we decide that we didn't need motions? We don't actually need to vote on these? Is that part of the conversation we have to have at this meeting, or is that the other one?
Yeah, if you're comfortable just asking for any objections,
Great.
that's a sufficient level.
Great. So we got some legal review because getting approval of minutes when different people are at different meetings is a little tricky. And as long as nobody has any objections to the minutes as transcribed, we will move forward from there. Any objections? Cool. Moving right along. Mr. Mann, the floor is yours. As you go around to the other side of the dais, yes.
Sound check. Can everyone hear
Yep.
me? Okay.
Yep.
I suppose I could do this from up there, but it sounds like I was a tiny dot for you, Treasurer. I'm not sure if it's better here. In any event, I will get started with my presentation. Treasurer Steiner and members of the Oregon Retirement Savings Board. My name is Ryan Mann. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Treasury Savings Network. Happy to provide a brief update on activities during the last quarter. Big one there listed as A is that we are in the midst of our enforcement pilot. Mentioned at the last board meeting that we signed an interagency agreement with the Bureau of Labor and Industries on December 20th, 2024, and since January have been engaged in a pilot phase of the enforcement work with our partner agency that's scheduled to conclude June 30th. We sent what we refer to as pre-enforcement communication in mid-January. These are employers we had been in touch with a number of times previously, but we sent one final letter reminding them of the requirement before sending a list over to a labor commissioner. That was 355 non-compliant employers received that pre-enforcement communication. I'm happy to report that more than 47% of that list subsequently took some action, either indicating an exemption or beginning the process to register and facilitate. So we were happy with that level of engagement as a result of that pre-enforcement mailing. And then in mid-February, sent the remaining employers over to Bully. As I mentioned, the pilot will be underway until June 30th, and we look forward to providing a more comprehensive update at the August meeting after we've seen the results of this pilot phase. I want to briefly acknowledge Renzo Mazon, our team, who's been managing the day-to-day work with Bully for this enforcement pilot. As you all know, we're the first program like this to launch. Certainly the first time Bully has worked on this type of enforcement, so there's a lot to learn as we go about this pilot. Thank you, Renzo, for all the work as we've gone about this pilot phase. Simultaneously, we're preparing for Wave 2025. As you all know, we have an annual registration deadline of July 31 for employers to register or indicate their exemption. So in the coming weeks and months, we will be communicating with approximately 8,200 employers who will receive communication both before and after that July 31 deadline. I think I've mentioned in the past, there's some who have sort of thought once the program was rolled out in the initial waves that there would be sort of a plateau period. And in fact, we have an annual opportunity to introduce the program to new employers and welcome new savers as a result. So much more to come on that in August and in November and in the months that follow. The other updates we have on the slide here are zooming out a little bit. The first category, financial empowerment. Our division that administers Oregon Saves at Treasury also administers the College Savings Plan, the ABLE Savings Plan, and has a broader financial empowerment and wellness mission. And as part of that, we annually recognize folks who are championing financial empowerment out there in the community. So this year, Becky Tucker from Caldera High School in Bend received the Financial Educator of the Year Award, and Uplift Leadership won the award for Community Champion. And a feature of that Community Champion Award is the recipient can then pay it forward and name another organization who's doing great work in the community. And they named the Oregon Trio Association in Astoria as the Pay It Forward recipient. So wanted to highlight that here because while not directly related to Oregon Saves, folks being more financially aware is a part of our broader mission, and the awards give us an opportunity to highlight that work. The Diversity and Leadership Scholarship is related to the College Savings Plan. And so this is a informational item for this board to know that we are trying to engage with underrepresented communities and help make a pathway to post-secondary education. I believe the recipients have been selected by a committee and are being finalized now. So again, more to come on that one. But an exciting scholarship that's now, I believe, in its fifth year. I think we have a full class of recipients of that scholarship out there pursuing post-secondary education. The Georgetown Center for Retirement Initiatives in March published a really comprehensive report on the national retirement savings landscape and produced profiles for all 50 states. The most exciting feature to me is it includes that pie chart we've talked about in this room with this board sometimes in the past, where we've acknowledged that the only metric for success isn't just accounts in Oregon Saves. It's also folks who are now saving through 401ks and other retirement options, whether or not that's a result of the Oregon Saves mandate. So in the state profile, we see for the first time those who are covered by private plans, those are that are covered by state plans, and an estimate on those that have been induced into a private plan as a result of the mandate here in Oregon. The national numbers indicate that 53% of private sector workers have access to an employer-sponsored retirement plan. And if you look at businesses with fewer than 50 employees, the number is just 37%. Happy to report that here in Oregon, we are at 62% of Oregon private sector employees with access, which places us, if not number one, very, very high on the national landscape. So that was we were happy to see that. Of course, that means 38% still don't. So that brings us back to the work we're doing around enforcement and broader outreach initiatives to close that gap completely. And I hope I'm not getting ahead of confirmation here, but we're hoping to have Angela Antonelli, who's the executive director of the Georgetown Center for Retirement Initiative, present to this board in August to go in more depth on that national report and the Oregon-specific information. And then last item here is a nod to one of our closest partners in this work at AARP, who did a lot of work over the last few weeks to highlight the fact that collectively, auto-enroll IRA plans have surpassed 1 million savers with funded accounts nationally. So Oregon Saves was the first, but there are now 20 states that have passed legislation, and about half of those are now up and running with accounts totaling, as I said, over 1 million now. I think we're here to stay. The very first accounts were opened here in Oregon, and I think it's fair to say that it's unclear what the future looked like, and I think now the future clearly includes a role for these state plans to help close that gap. So it was a nice opportunity to reconnect with AARP and do some nice promotions of that milestone. That is all the information I was planning to share. I want to briefly note that I believe after me on the agenda is a security strategy session with Matt Konopinski, the Chief Information Security Officer and Senior Vice President of Vestwell, and Rob Mulchin, who's the Chief Technology Officer at Vestwell. And I don't mean to take a hard turn from all the exciting updates I shared, but as much as I enjoy celebrating the growth in accounts and assets, the reality is that our success also makes us more attractive to bad actors and makes security all the more important for our program. There's a lot that we have to think about administering these programs, everything from investments to marketing to public policy to data analytics, behavioral economics, community engagement, customer service. And much of that is as I said, fun to think about, brainstorm ways we can reach more people. I probably rank more important than any other responsibility is the security of the data for our account holders and, of course, the funds in their accounts. So with that responsibility, we have some great partners at Vestwell who manage the day-to-day to help keep our account holders safe. And I will not say any more about data security because that's really the extent of my expertise is to indicate that it's very important and it's an area that we monitor very actively. I'm, of course, happy to answer questions before I exit stage, right? Otherwise, I will hand it off to our colleagues at Vestwell.
Questions for Mr. Mann after that really exciting presentation, because we're really making excellent progress here. I'm actually delighted to hear that we got such a high level of response to those initial letters. I mean, employers are notorious for ignoring things like that. And to my mind, I'm not an expert on this stuff, but a 47% return is not half bad. Now let's hope that they all finish up doing what they're supposed to do. But it'll be interesting to see what it takes to get the remaining 53% to comply. Ms. DeMona and Ms. Backus, I can't see hands, so you're going to have to wave loud. Thank you. Go ahead, Ms. Backus.
Thank you. Thanks for the update, and congratulations to those award winners, too. I appreciate hearing about that. I just wanted to kind of piggyback on what Treasurer Steiner just had to say about the BOLI initiative, because I agree that 47% is great, and we know that there are lots of employers out there that probably do qualify for an exemption or have gone out of business or for one reason or another are just, you know, not able to participate. So that's good and nice to just clean the books. But we have to focus on this 53%. And I'd just be, I don't know if Renzo or you, Ryan, can give some just a little bit more meat on the bone in terms of what are the next steps from BOLI and what, if you, to the extent you know, and you can speak for them, I guess, what the next steps might be.
Absolutely. Thank you, Ms. Backus. I do look forward to a more comprehensive report in August. I can say at this point that when we transmitted the list in mid-February, the next step was for BOLI to take in that information and then turn around and send their own communication to the employers indicating that they've been made aware of their lack of compliance. And we are now at the stage where we're working through how many have begun the payroll process and have completed it. And for those who haven't, you know, we're trying to be mindful of what our role is and what the labor commissioner's role is in terms of how they proceed with their process and whether they choose to levy fines or the next steps that they may take. But we are literally in the midst of that phase right now. I'm going to briefly look back just to Renzo to, if he starts waving his hands, let me know to stop. But I think we just hit the 30-day mark where employers who receive that communication, if they immediately turned around and began facilitating payroll, we would now be seeing that. So we're taking in that information, sharing that with BOLI so that they can make their determination on next steps. The nature of the plan is, as you indicated, not necessarily an obvious binary of in compliance or not, because there's several steps involved in registering and facilitating payroll, and there's a lag time involved in that. The narrow time frame of the pilot means that a lot of this is somewhat accelerated, hoping to give us a sense of both efficacy and the workload required so we can be informed in our sort of long-term plans when we go to scale. So I know that I just said a lot and didn't fully answer your question. I hope that that's helpful in providing a little bit of context, and I think we'll have a better, more detailed report around exactly how many employers that we sent to BOLI did come into compliance and how they dealt with the ones who did not. Okay.
Any follow-up, Ms. Backus?
No, thank you. That's helpful.
Great. Ms. DeMona, anything?
I'm good. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Mann, it does make me wonder one other thing. You mentioned that there are approximately 8,500 new employers who would be part of this 2025 wave. These two questions you may well not have the answer to, and if you don't, then just email them to the board members, please. The first question is, out of curiosity, is how does that number of 8,500 compare to previous years for new employers? I'm just curious because it also reflects what's happening in Oregon's economy. And the second is, historically, what percentage of new employers comply up front? And, you know, what's the tail look like in terms of what we have to do to get them to comply? Because I can't imagine that all of them do. Otherwise, we wouldn't be running. I mean, on the other hand, I suspect new employers are probably more likely to do it because they just see it as part of the cost of setting up a business, you know, cost, if you will, of setting up a business.
Thank you, Treasurer Steiner. I on that last point, that is our hope as well. If it feels like it's part of the various steps you go through in creating your business or establishing an organization, we're hoping for a higher uptake for new employers. I can actually speak to your first question, and I thought it might come up. Last year, there were around 15,000 employers who we communicated with as part of Wave 2024. So I actually asked the team if we had theories as to the delta between those two numbers. And one is that we were including some from previous years who had not been part of the initial rollout because of when they were formed and when we sent communication. So it's possible that 15,000 was sort of an inflated number because there was some catch up happening. But I agree with your observation that if that's not the case, it does provide some information on a sort of macroeconomic standpoint on creation of new employers. I'll see if we can find information that sort of indicates an average and tells us how.
I would imagine Corporations Division at Secretary of State could help with that, because they must track that statistic, right? So
yeah, we'll poke around on that and follow up with.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate
confirmation.
It. It's not a big deal. I'm just curious. So it'll be interesting to see how this plays out.
Absolutely. So. And Treasurer, regarding your second question, I'm not able to answer that on the spot. I'm wondering if we can get the answer in the course of the meeting and provide it before
absolutely.
We adjourn or otherwise via follow-up. I know we have that data on what the registration rate is initially and over time. So if we can't provide it in the meeting, we'll certainly follow up with that.
Great. Thank you so much. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Mann.
Thank you.
Mr. Konopinski, I think you are up, my friend.
Incredible. Treasurer Steiner, other members of the Treasury Board, thank you for having both myself and Rob Mulch on here today to present to you. Although Rob's name is not listed on this slide, he is our Chief Technology Officer, and he is also my comfort support animal. I pretty much take Rob wherever I go. He pets me when I need to be, or he comforts me when I need it. And he's going to have a few words as well to say, I think, here today at some
and
point.
And I'm but sorry to interrupt you, but can you just officially introduce yourself rather than me introducing you?
Absolutely,
record?
Treasurer Steiner.
Thank you.
Yes. My name is Matt Konopinski. I'm the Chief Information Security Officer at Bestwell, as well as the Senior Vice President of Information Systems and Compliance.
Thank you. We just have to follow the rules for public meetings.
Understood. I should know by now after 3 years of
it's okay.
To the board.
It's okay.
Okay, sure. So if we wanted to move one slide forward. Today's discussion is going to be centered around the cybersecurity landscape, as well as some of the threats and different types of vulnerabilities that we're seeing around the industry, along with what Bestwell is doing to protect both participant information and participant funds from these malicious actors. The first slide we have here today shows a little bit about the different verticals being impacted by cybersecurity threats today and e-crime in general. You'll see that both technology and financial services top the list. Bestwell plays in both of these sectors. Therefore, it creates a little bit more of a vulnerable situation for Bestwell, which means we have to put a stronger lens on cybersecurity, which you'll see in the coming slides we do through a few different comprehensive programs that we run internally. If we'd like to move to the next slide, this shows different malicious actor groups that have popped up around the globe. Some of these are new, some of these are old, and although they have really cute names like Cruel Jackal or Cozy Bear or Royal Spider, these are extremely bad actors that are simply going for money. Why are they going for money? The money helps push other agendas. A lot of these are nation-state attacks that are coming at us these days. And you'll see with spots in South Asia, Middle East, as well as North Africa, a lot of the money runs dry from the nation state funded attacks. Therefore, they need to go for private money in order to continue these attacks. I'll touch on that a little bit more later, but figured I would show you a little bit about what the names of these groups are. Here are some really interesting 2025 cybersecurity headlines that I thought would be interesting. And you'll see that a majority of these are nation state based. You'll see China in there. You will see Ukraine. You will see Egyptian government entities in there. This should really give us a pause for concern, because we're starting to see more money flood in from government agencies to continue attacking and to continue these attacks on foreign adversaries. We are keeping a close eye on this. We do know that these are the latest data intrusion and breaches that have far-reaching scale. So if we go to the next slide, this one being the most concerning, and this should resonate with this group. Treasury's Office of the Comptroller of the Currency disclosed to Congress that hackers intercepted 103 bank regulators' emails. They had actually been inside the OCC for over a year. This individual was looking at emails of the OCC. There's a tremendous number of emails that had confidential information and sensitive information in there about different OCC programs and participants. So all of these slides lead up to me now talking a little bit about Bestwell's posture and the approach that we take to ensuring that PII sensitive data and the money in accounts are secure. We look at application architecture. Application architecture means we're shifting security left. We're ensuring that cybersecurity is part of the discussion early when we're talking about product ideation or the creation of a new product or feature. We are making sure that both Rob and myself and our chief product officer, Ryan Anderson, are thinking about security and ensuring that it's embedded inherently in the application. Our securing the software supply chain posture is very much understanding all the different components that go about making up the Bestwell product that we deliver, ensuring that all of the vendors that have access to data or information are accounted for, and that we perform regular risk assessments against them to ensure that they're holding up to our customer standards of security and requirements. Our threat modeling and security tooling. You might have heard me talk in the past about our use of CrowdStrike or Nightfall for DLP, which is data loss prevention. We're ensuring that every piece of tooling or utility that we bring in-house at Bestwell is ensuring the security of our customers. So we put a really fine focus on that. And the last piece here is obviously compliance. We perform an annual SOC 2. We make sure that all of the different components at Bestwell undergo risk review. We ensure that any new vendors that are being onboarded go through risk program. And we're certainly not taking any chances. If we go to the next slide, please. This is really more of the team capabilities. What I wanted to outline here were all of the different points of experience that members of the team have and all of the different areas that we really like to address under each of these pillars. Compliance and governance obviously being one of the most important. We're taking a step forward with automation and trying to bring more automation to our governance frameworks. We're trying to rely a little bit less on the human aspect of our governance and compliance programs and ensure that every year we're kind of putting ourselves out there to onboard automated tasks and automated programs that are checking us in real time against our compliance frameworks. I'm going to move further down. I'm not going to talk necessarily about the application security. I think Rob would probably touch on that at some point. But cloud security, we are using AWS. We are ensuring that all of our containers are scanned. We are ensuring that all of our code is scanned as it's deployed in real time. We also have environment segregation to ensure that production environments never cross over with QA or any type of development environments. And data asset management really being the most important. The protection of PII and our customer data is our North Star. So we're always looking for different ways to continue securing that data and making sure that we keep it in focus for all of our employees. Next slide,
Mr. Konopinski, before you go, oh, well, maybe you got there. Maybe you're talking about the next slide about what you're doing. I mean, honest to goodness, the vast majority, as far as I understand it, of security breaches are wetware failures, i.e. all of us human beings who screw up and open emails we shouldn't open or click on links we shouldn't click on. And so I'm just curious about that, but it looks like you've got a fair amount of that there.
That's correct, Madam Treasurer.
Sorry.
No.
I am notorious for asking questions about whatever's going to be on the next slide.
That's fantastic. No, and you bring up a very good point. Some of the largest risks are internal risks. So we have a pretty comprehensive program around security training, and we actually make phishing part of that. So I'll skip one down from ransomware and talk a little bit about phishing. So we use a platform called KnowBefore. The KnowBefore platform internally actually sends periodic, right now it's quarterly, emails to all of the Bestwell employees pretending to be a malicious actor, and we're essentially testing them. Each of those employees gets a grade essentially at the end of this phishing program. And we know whether they opened the email, we know if they clicked on a link, we know if they forwarded the email. All of these different things that, to your point earlier, lead to internal data breaches or compromised infrastructure, we're able to actually view that and see which employees could be high risk. A score is assigned to them, and then we mandate additional security training for them. And we will go through on an individual basis training them and ensuring that they understand all of the risks. So we do have some pretty comprehensive training programs, security training programs in place that are both tooling and utility based, as well as just standardized training, whether that be through Zoom or in-person meetings. Social engineering is always a big one. Social engineering, which is you could be sitting in a coffee shop and perhaps bring up an important email. And somebody next to you could be shoulder surfing and could see that, right? Social engineering could be someone looking on your LinkedIn and seeing, you know, that you work for the Treasury Department, and then reaching out to one of your fellow Treasury members and saying, Madam Treasurer asked me to reach out to you and ask you for access to a certain file, right? There are all these different things that are attack vectors and threats, and social engineering is a big part of that. Then our general security threats that we see on a regular basis. We're seeing a lot of geopolitical and ideological threats, or countries rather, I should say, that are associated with geopolitical and ideological threats. We do have really strong security frameworks in place to protect us against those. We've seen a tremendous amount coming from Romania recently. We've also seen some from Germany, which is very odd. However, these malicious actors will use different locations in order to perform their attacks, and they will use several different VPNs or IP blocks. If we move to the next slide, please. I know that Ryan and I have spoken extensively about this, or Mr. Mann and I have spoken extensively about this around AI, and I'm looking forward to continuing that discussion. But Vestwell has taken a stance that we will look into AI. However, we will walk and not run to it. We cannot have unchecked AI adoption within the Vestwell workplace. We know that there are certain threats associated with AI, but we've also identified areas where AI can be certainly helpful for us, and areas where we want to leverage AI because we feel like it could benefit contributors to the platform. However, once again, I'll let the entire Treasury Board know that we have tremendous risk oversight on any AI adoption. And this is not something that we take lightly. Any of the AI that we are pursuing now, we control all of the models. So the data is ours. The data is not publicly available. It does not contain at all any contributor information or sensitive information. This is all just standard help center information that you may be able to get out on the internet on the Vestwell page. So we're looking at slow adoption. Again, it's all checked. We're walking, not running into it. If I could go to the next page. Oh, geez. Okay. Wow. I'm done already. So
you're very efficient.
But I try to be. In security, you have to be, right?
Yeah, I get it.
Yeah. So I want to open the floor to you, Treasury Board and Madam Treasurer.
I already barged in once, so I'm going to defer to Ms. Backus and Ms. DeMonin first. And by the way, I am very formal in these meetings. But nobody else has a requirement to be. I just do it because that's how I was trained in the legislature. So that's on me. You guys don't have to worry about it. It's up to you. So Ms. Backus, Ms. DeMonin, you're going to have to wave.
I have a quick question.
Sure.
I guess I'm curious on the AI front, what the process is. I mean, if you know, as you decide to roll out certain components of AI over time, I hear you saying that you'll do it slowly and thoughtfully, but I'm just curious kind of within Vestwell, how that works. Is that a decision that you and your team make, or does it get rolled up to the kind of the board or somebody at different departments, or how do you make that decision to sort of integrate some of these new technologies into your work?
That's a great question. Thank you. It's great that we have Rob here, our Chief Technology Officer. I think this might be a nice time, Rob, if you'd like to speak about that.
I'll take myself off mute. For the record, I'm Rob Molsher, and I'm the CTO here at Vestwell. I've been at Vestwell for coming up on 4 years now. And as part of my job, security, corporate IT, all the software engineering, all the testing, all the provisioning of cloud resources, et cetera, falls in my realm. So talking about AI, which also is part of my mandate, there's a few areas that, well, I guess there's to address your question. So when we adopt new technology, any AI product, of course, goes through the risk committee that any new vendor would go through for our vendor onboarding process. In addition, we've been very clear that we want to not use, allow use of public AI resources. We control that so that we don't have any data escaping out into the wild. Often when you're using the free version of whatever service it is, if you upload information, if you include your emails, et cetera, that is used for training purposes, which cannot necessarily directly be revealed to a data leak, but it often can put information out there in the world that you don't want. And it can be challenging now because the AI providers are not necessarily abiding by some of the rules that the search engines go for in terms of excluding data. So first off is we make sure we understand what the vendor is and who the vendor works with, make sure their policies are in accordance with our own. And the second part is we make sure that we understand the use case that AI is going to be proposed for. So we have a committee that includes myself and the head of product, as well as Matt, and we talk about how we're doing it. So, for instance, we do use some AI to respond to online requests in our 401k platform. So if you ask a question, the bot will try the best to answer your question, but it reveals it's a bot, et cetera, and we make sure that it does not have access to private information that's not leaked out. I hope that answers your question. That's how we kind of control it. We've had a couple of decisions to use an internal tool called Glean to make sure our data is available through an AI-like resource, but that's not public. And we've also taken some other vendors into account. A lot of times now vendors are introducing AI into their products, and we make sure before that's turned on that we understand how that data is going to be used and how it's going to be stored by the vendor itself.
Ms. Backus, thanks, Rob. And Ms. Backus, just to add one additional thing to that, we do have a risk committee. As part of risk committee, we review all vendors, and AI is a huge part of that. Any new platform that is onboarded at Vestwell, as Rob said, goes through the entire risk review program. And I think we've provided you documentation around what that risk review program looks like. But it is certainly, as Rob said, part of that risk review program. And it contains several members of the executive board, as you had initially asked about.
You anticipated my follow-up question, so thank you.
Okay.
You're good like that.
Try to be.
Okay. Other questions? Mr. Mann, anything you want to add to this conversation?
No. I mean, I thank you, Treasurer. I said my piece at the beginning. This is very important for us. Having this on the agenda annually has become a tradition that I think will continue to emphasize its importance. I didn't mention previously, but I receive reports on, attempts on fraud with our accounts. We're in regular communication to try to monitor the threats that are coming in. So we will continue to do that and keep the board apprised if the landscape changes. But just want to emphasize how important it is.
Thank you. We appreciate that, and I know all the account holders do as well. So that's great. Thank you both, Mr. Kompinski, Mr. Moulton. I really appreciate it. Thanks for being here with us. Okay, we are moving on to Mr. Golden for program administration. Hello, Mr. Golden. Come on up.
There we go. Good afternoon, Treasurer Steiner, members of the board. Good to see you again. Matt Golden with Vestwell. I'd like to share a brief update focused on some of the enhancements that we have been rolling out this year with a few status updates, and then followed by a brief overview of the state of the states in the state auto IRA savings space. So if you would not mind, go to the first slide. Thank you. So one of the enhancements that we rolled out at the beginning of the year was an investment and improvement in the Know Your Customer customer identification profile program. Excuse me. We made a change not only taking this kind of process into Vestwell, but also by changing the data sources that we use to identify people as required by law when we open up an IRA account for them. And so our previous pass rate was around 60% for the Oregon Saves program. That means 6 out of 10 folks that were added, employees that were added by their employer, were passing through and able to be auto-enrolled. But about 4 out of 10 we needed additional information from. So since we've made this change, our pass rate is now up to over, I don't want to get too far ahead of it, it's only been a few months, but slightly above 75%. So just a huge change in the amount of people. So if we have 100 employees are added, instead of 60 passing through without any additional information, we're now, you know, well over 75, which means overall, it just makes it simpler for people to save without having to provide additional information. So we're pretty happy about the early results of this change, and just wanted to bring that to you. We'll continue to provide updates, but that was a big improvement for the program.
That's great.
Thank you. Two other big changes I wanted just to make you aware of. So the customer service center, so how we service employees and employers who call in to have questions about the program or to make changes. So back in the fall of last year, we insourced the employer call center from our partners at Bank of New York directly into Vestwell, and that's gone very well. We're now making the next change, which is to bring the employees of the Saver servicing into Vestwell as well. So we're looking at this point, we're targeting a date in late July to have the servicing transition over. And we're really excited about this. While folks are being serviced very well today and we're meeting all our service levels, we think that we can bring a lot of additional resources to the customer experience. I'll give you an example. So one of the things that we're introducing, and I think that that Rob and Matt touched on it a little bit, is just additional tools. So we're going to be able to route calls more efficiently. So if somebody's calling to opt out, we can handle that one way and handle that through a voice solution first, have it done very simply. Or if an employer is calling to exempt, introduce a voice solution to have an employer exempt, while our customer service team can focus on people that have questions about the program or making changes to their account and less on those kind of basic transactional type items. One other thing that we're introducing is, along with the way to contact the program, there's always the 800 number. We've always had an email to allow employers or employees to email. The problem with email is that somebody has to read it and then respond, and that takes time. So while email isn't going away, we're going to introduce live chat, which will be handled by the Vestwell customer service agent team. So live chat will get you an immediate answer to your question as opposed to the email route.
So, live chat is the best. I got to tell you, every customer platform I'm on where I have an option to use live chat, it is always my preferred way to do it. Don't have to wait on hold. You can do other things. It's great.
Thank you, Treasurer Steiner, for that endorsement. And I will always, just one other public service announcement. Sorry, I know this is a public meeting. If you ever need to have a flight change and you're in line, go to live chat. Don't go to the service desk. Okay.
Nope. Mr. Golden is 100% correct. Okay. Been there, done that, and got done with my problems faster than anybody else.
There you go. Okay, great. Well, that's a great example. I think that we concur. It's just an additional feature that we can bring to Savers employers who are contacting the program with the goal of giving the best customer service experience, but getting them the answer to their question as quickly as possible. So we're excited about this ongoing transition. And as I said, we're looking to transition kind of latter half of July at this point. Okay. All right. One other update. I just want to share a few updates on the payroll side. We know payroll is very important. Just to make it simple or more easy for employers to facilitate the program. One thing I wanted to note is that when the Oregon Saves program came over to Vestwell, we had less than 10 payroll integrations. Now we're up to 46 different integrations. So this is an ongoing process. It's not just one and done. So we're happy about that. We have an integrations team. If we're contacted by a payroll provider, we try to slot them in and get that integration set up as quickly as possible. So the list keeps expanding. But two big changes that we made recently, one is we launched a solution for those employers working with ADP. So we're excited about that. That is a third-party solution. So it's
that has been a long time coming. I'm really pleased to hear that.
Yep. Thank you. And then the next big payroll provider, hopefully, we'll have in place is Paychex. And so we are, I don't want to give a specific date. I'm just going to continue to say later this year as this year moves on. So exciting updates on the payroll slide. And anyway, we will just continue to build out these capabilities and just make it simpler for employers who do use a payroll provider who's integrated to have that process. Not be something they have to be responsible for on a weekly or biweekly, monthly basis. Okay, one more slide from me.
Sorry, can I ask one quick question about that, please. Mr. Golden? Sorry. Excuse me. Am I correct in thinking that, or is it possible, and maybe Mr. Mann can add in here, you know, one of the reasons that we have this whole backlog of employers who haven't, we believe, and I think it's obvious from the response we're getting to those 350 test emails that we sent out, those test letters that we sent out to non-compliant employers, that some of them already are compliant because they have something going on. Either they're doing it with they're doing something themselves with one of these payroll providers like ADP or Paychex, or they're doing something different altogether. Is it possible for that information to be uploaded back to never mind. I just answered my own question. Ignore me. Sorry. I was misunderstanding something. You guys aren't getting data on people who are setting up a program. Like, I happen to know a bar owner in Portland who, when 2 years ago, whenever when he was sort of on the tail end of having to set this up, said, well, ADP offers a 401k program, so I'm just going to do it through them. But your payroll integration doesn't let you see which employers have done that. It only lets you get payroll integration so that it's easy for people who are using ADP to have their employees' money dumped straight into their Oregon Saves account.
That's right? Correct, Treasurer Steiner.
Yeah, it was my bad. I realized that in the middle of my sentence.
However,
yeah, it's my fault.
I will say, though, one of the services we provide and what we do is we screen for 5,500 filings on an ongoing basis. So on an annual basis, we'll look to see if we have an employer in the Oregon Saves program with a tax ID that has not taken an action. We'll see if that employer matches the latest 5,500 filings at the end of the year for the prior year. And we do catch and identify some of those employers who have since started a retirement plan and can exempt them and go through, mark them as 5,500 exempt. So not the same.
That's helpful.
Yeah.
No, but it's better than nothing for sure.
That's correct. And you did, and before I go to the last slide, you did remind me of your earlier question. If I could just address the action rate question from Wave 2024. So the action rate, and I didn't have this off the top of my head, full disclosure. It was texted to me. So it was 48% for Wave 2024, 90 days after the deadline. And so that's an action rate. So an action rate is a percentage of employers who took an action, whether they exempted or registered for the program. And so we mentioned that was about 14,000 or so employers last year. So we would expect a similar action rate during the deadline period from this wave 2025. If you were curious about how many of those, there were 2,500 of those employers last year registered. And of that population, about 800 of them are now actively submitting payroll. So,
okay.
There's a funnel, obviously, but I would say from an overall response rate, that is pretty good from the deadline period for employers to respond, but you're still left with about half of those employers who would eventually fall into the pre-enforcement enforcement process.
So, again, I may be getting too far into the weeds here, and if so, just tell me not to. And I also recognize that our program is a little different from other states because we go down to employers who are their only employee, right? Whereas a lot of states stop at five or fewer, right? Mm-hmm. Employees. Yeah. But do we have any sense about how conversion rates, compliance rates match between Oregon and other states? I mean, I could see these employers with one or two employees might be less likely to comply than an employer with 10 employees, right?
Yeah.
But I can't know that for a fact.
It's a good question. And we have access to that information. And if you would allow me to some time to come back with that, I think that would be a good thing for the
absolutely. That'd be great. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Okay. On that note, though, it is a great lead into the next slide. So this is just a simple view that our team put together. These are all the states that are active. And the order, just to orient you on this slide, is the order of when the program launched. So Oregon Saves was first, then Illinois Secure Choice, then Cal Savers, et cetera. And you can see the threshold, that's the number of employees where the state mandate or the minimum. And as Treasurer Steiner mentioned, Oregon Saves is one or more. The other is the program assets as of April 1st, and then the number of folks saving in the program, the number of registered employers, and then a phase. And this is just something that our team called out of those states that are actively in the enforcement process. Other states are still what we call pre-enforcement, their past rollout, and are working through their process. And then other states are newer. You can see here there are 15 states that are active. Three states at near the bottom, New York, Rhode Island, and Nevada will be launching this year. And then Minnesota is in the middle of an RFP process to hire a program administrator and, you know, likely to launch either the end of this year or into 2026. You can see the asset numbers and obviously all the other figures. And states are in different programs. But as Mr. Mann stated, if you add up all these assets, now close to $2 billion that have been saved in state-mandated auto IRA programs. So it's a pretty high-level view, but I thought it would be interesting for you, for the board, to see where the programs stand at this level at this point. And what phase they're in. I don't know if there's any questions about all that data or all the information that I presented. Yes.
Oh. I was just glad to see the ADP coming on board, and just curious if there's like this critical mass now that it makes like an organization or a business like ADP, they can't ignore us anymore because now we have all of these states, and is there enough similarity among the programs, I guess, for like ADP to, I guess they have to, you know, make everything line up the criteria state by state by state, because they're all different. But do you have any thoughts on that reaction?
Yes, sure. No, I appreciate the question. One point of clarification. So ADP, we do offer integration for employers who use ADP as their payroll provider. However, the integration is through a third-party provider, so it's not a direct integration with ADP. So there is a third party who ADP has works with to make the integration available. And so that company's name is Payroll Integrations. They do what they say, I guess. I'll put it that way. On board to a degree through a third party, where all the other integrations we have are direct one-to-one to Vastwell. To your question, it is not a unique integration by state program. So it is simply an integration with a provider like ourselves. So anytime an integration is established between Vestwell and a payroll provider, it applies across all states, unless it's a regional payroll company who just doesn't have, you know, businesses on the East Coast or the West Coast. So there's nothing additional that an ADP or a Paychex needs to do other than just be aware that this particular employer in this particular state could use SyncUp for that integration. So once it's set up, or if it's set up for one state, it applies, at least the way that Vestwell does it, across all state programs. So that's a good thing, and it makes it simpler for the integration to take shape. So, ADP, we'll see what the adoption is, because there is a third party in between, but it is a good start and it is available.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thanks for that question. Other questions for Mr. Golden? Yeah, go ahead.
So I just want to make sure that I was hearing your numbers right from a minute ago when we were talking about the 15,000 or so from 2024. Yeah. That came in as kind of the new employer group, which may or may not have included some
2023. Yes.
And then I think you said that of that 15,000, about 800 employers actually are engaged in the payroll process currently. So that's just roughly
5%. Yes.
And I know we've gone through this exercise before, where we've looked at kind of the fall off and the reasons why employers are not making it through the chain, but I think it would be helpful for us to see that again this year for our 8,200 that are coming. And I would just like to kind of continue to track that and also to see kind of more detail if possible, so that we can kind of see again. I know we've done this before, but I think it's helpful for us to be reminded of kind of why these employers are falling out, or, you know, some of them are in the pipeline. And just to understand how many are in the pipeline, how many are just non-responsive, what's going on with those?
Absolutely. Happy to share that. And we did a deep dive on that a couple of years ago, and we'll do it again, and we'll do it ongoing. But I think when we looked at the wave six populations, it was very interesting for the board and for us to look at those employers that had 1 to 2 employees and 3 to 4 employers. And that was back in 23. Where we saw that the registration number can be very high, but if you only have one employee, maybe it's yourself or 2 employees, the likelihood of you actually coming to the point of submitting payroll is very low. And I think that's when you look at those numbers from 24, the reason why, in my view, the number one reason why there's such a big drop off between registrations and actual submitting payroll, it's just a function of the program mandate size going down to 1 employee. But let's look at it again this year and see how it all shakes out. We'll go through that data in more detail.
Okay.
Right.
To Ms. Backus's point, though, it will be interesting to do a little bit of a more in-depth analysis to see about compliance level based on number of employees, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we can take a look at that also.
Absolutely.
Great. Okay. Anything else from Mr. Golden? Thank you, as always, Mr. Golden. Appreciate the report. Mr. Fitzgerald, talk to us about program data. Come on down.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is Ryan Fitzgerald from Sellwood Investment Partners. I'll be doing program data. So, you know, love the new format. Please ask as many questions as they come up, and we're, you know, always happy to answer them when we can, and come back with answers when we don't. This quarter, as a brief overview, if we could flip forward there one, actually, thank you. Three things, all good. Increase in assets for the program, increase in account holders, and increase in the savings rate. So the increase in the savings rate, up to 7.1%, that's an automatic increase. So folks, you know, once they hit the new year, their savings rate bumps up 1% until they hit the 10% limit, unless they elect otherwise. Increase in AUM and increase in accounts, that's as expected. Even with, and we'll get into market performance at a later period in this presentation or a later agenda item, excuse me, assets up as well as accounts. So nothing much to report on the quarterly dashboard, just those three things I would, you know, keep in the back of your mind. I think that certainly is the overview. I think there's some more interesting things to look at beneath the scenes, given kind of market volatility over the last quarter. If we could go forward then. So we deemed this saver behavior. We were trying to get a look at, you know, what was the what was individual savers, what was their behavior across the program during what we saw was a heightened period of market volatility and, you know, heightened headlines surrounding the investment markets, and particularly the S&P and any type of U.S.-based investment following the tariff-related sell-off. Really, that portion that we've highlighted in the box is the important part. So that's between mid-February, February 19th to be exact, and April 7th or 8th, I can't remember if it's April 7th or 8th, but between that time period, there was a 20% drawdown in the S&P 500. The markets were quite volatile. They had several days of, you know, plus 8% up or down within the S&P, which is a pretty remarkable intraday change. So, you know, our thought was that we would take a look at saver behavior in terms of assets moving into and out of the program, switching investment options, given the kind of heightened level of volatility. So if we could go for one, actually, that'd be great. What we saw was, you know, it was not a lot of movement, quite honestly. You know, I was a bit surprised given kind of the overall market headlines, and we looked at this a few different ways. The important one, I think, here is to first look at the tan bar in the middle, particularly for March and April. And these, you know, usually we just go through quarter end, but this goes through April. So we got a clearer picture about how the you know, the April 2nd Liberation Day headlines impacted saver behavior. You'll notice 5.5 million out in April. That matches 5.5 million out in January. On a net basis, so those are the charts that are down at the bottom with the gray, net basis contributions continue to come in the program at a steady rate, at a rate that looks exactly like it did in the preceding months. So we did not see any behavior of changed withdrawals or contributions given the market headlines, which was encouraging. We looked at this another way, and that's on the next page. This is the first 4 months of each preceding year, and then the first 4 months of 2025 as well. Contributions there you'll see in green. Roughly 46 million this year, 45 million last year. Part of that number last year is a little inflated thanks to the AFSCME contributions. You'll notice as well just below that in the tan, 24.3 million out. You'll notice that the monotonic kind of increase there that has happened over the last few years. So, you know, even though that distributions were about 4 million more out of the program this year compared to the first 4 months of last year, it isn't to us that alarming given that the program's now bigger and there's more assets and there's more accounts. It's been a pretty steady increase in both contributions and distributions throughout the course of the program. So we didn't see anything there that suggested kind of categorical changes to the way that savers were behaving. You know, no kind of increase in withdrawals and a steady continuation of contributions. We've looked at a few other ways. The next page is investment option flows. And the top chart in green there, that is monthly contributions into capital preservation. And the hypothesis there being that investors seeing market headlines would switch into something safe, quote unquote safe, in terms of cash, the capital preservation option here. That top chart is the contributions into cash, and it looks like there is not much of a pattern there, given kind of the heightened volatility that we saw in March and April. So also nice to see that, you know, investors aren't panicking. You know, another way we looked at that was the distributions out of the target retirement date suite and the growth option. And so, you know, 5.1 out in April. April is typically a very high month for distributions in general from any type of savings vehicle due to taxes. And so that 5.1 out in April, just slightly more than the 5.0 out in January. And nothing that, at least to our eyes anyway, suggests that savers were reallocating their investments away from quote unquote risky target retirement date funds into other sources or withdrawing it from the program. The last way we looked at that, and this is our weekly cash flows. This is our last chart. This is the weekly cash flow. So again, the volatile period, we'll call it starting mid, you know, the peak of the market was somewhere in mid-February, and the sell-off lasted between then and early April. And, you know, the similar numbers here. So the top chart is green, it's weekly contributions. These are obviously they shorter time period, so they bump around a little bit more than the monthly numbers. But from our eyes, we did not see any type of you know, real shift in investor behavior in just the ways that we were able to look at it, looking at aggregated flows. So that's not to say that everyone had the same reaction, but in aggregate, we weren't able to see any type of real big impact to saver behavior due to the market volatility, which was a pretty welcome finding for us anyway. That I think that, that's something that you do worry about, that to sell at the wrong time is a great way to destroy wealth long term. So that was it for our presentation this quarter. Any kind of questions on program data in general? I thought, you know, increase in AUM, increase in accounts, increase in savings rates, and people didn't shift their behavior given that, that there was a 20% drawdown in a very swift amount of time. I think those are all good positives.
Well, that was nifty. Okay. We're making excellent. No. I'm nifty, but that was not a snarky nifty. That was a serious nifty, because it is very reassuring to see that people's behavior really didn't change with all the economic volatility. And I think it's a credit to Mr. Mann and his team with the communications they've been doing with savers and to the Vestwell team and Selwood for sort of not doing anything to get anybody anxious and providing the stable service that you've provided for years. So this is reassuring and I'm very pleased to hear it. Ms. Backus, looks like you got your hand up.
Yes, thank you. I just have a quick comment, which is that in this, you know, turbulent market environment, I guess I think about the changes we made to the capital preservation timeline. I believe it's 30 days now, is that right?
That's correct.
And, you know, there was a lot of consternation at the time that we made that decision about, you know, what the right time frame was and you know, the realities of our program and cost to the program, et cetera. And I think it's important in this environment to keep that in mind. I'm not suggesting that we make any changes necessarily, but I think that we, you know, I worry about new savers who are putting their, you know, low income folks who are putting not a lot of money into the plan and could see it evaporate overnight. And, you know, whether we might at some point, if this market volatility will continue for years and months and longer, whether we would consider, you know, lengthening that period if we feel like we are putting those new savers at risk or causing them to have a that experience with the program at the offset or at the outset or decide to opt out. So it's just something that I'm thinking about right now and just wanted to kind of.
Thanks. Appreciate it. Mr. Mann, did you want to add anything to that? You look like you were leaning in to speak.
Oh, thank you, Treasurer. No, not necessarily. I appreciate the flag. It is something I think we should continue to think about as the program continues to mature and we get a better sense of the saver behavior we do see during these times. I think it's informative to a lot of decisions around communication, investment lineup, default rates, all of those things. So no, nothing other than thanking Ms. Backus for raising it and yeah, saying that we should continue to have those conversations.
And I'm busy trying not to wince when Ms. Backus talks about ongoing volatility. after last week's state economic forecast.
Not a statement.
I know. But it still makes me anxious, especially after last week's revenue forecast. Although, thank God I'm not the co-chair of the budget committee anymore, because it's got to be ugly over there. Okay. Mr. Fitzgerald, do you want to move on to the performance report piece of your presentation?
Yes, and for this portion, and I'll have Kevin introduce himself as well, but I'll invite Kevin Raymond from CELA to come up and
come on up.
Put him on the spot. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know if I have that power, but he got invited.
Good afternoon, Treasurer Steiner, members of the board. Kevin Raymond. There we go. Sorry about that. Good afternoon, Treasurer Steiner, members of the board. Kevin Raymond from CELA Investment Partners. So we're going to give you, and I'll try to, as we've kind of alluded to, there's a lot that's been going on in the markets. We'll try to give you kind of a brief summary and happy to answer questions along the way. We move forward one page. So this is as of March 31st. I'll give a little bit of color about, you know, what's happened afterwards, since obviously there has been a lot. As Ryan Fitzgerald mentioned earlier, the first half of the first quarter was very similar to, you know, the 7 or 8 quarters before that we talked about, where leadership was really in the largest technology names, so Magnificent Seven, a lot of U.S. Large cap, and we saw, you know, the S&P 500 up almost over 4% during that period. We got to mid-February, and investors started to worry about growth. You know, there was a lot of questions about what U.S. trade policy was going to be, how that might impact growth. And so we started to see a real transition in the markets. And so, you know, for the first time in, you know, a number of quarters, we actually, you know, saw a kind of a change in leadership that required some diversification in portfolios. And, you know, Ryan will talk a little bit later about how that played out in these funds. But you can see here on the left-hand side of the page that the losses that we saw in the first quarter were all in U.S. Stocks, so large cap and small cap stocks. You know, if you kind of, you know, sat through the quarter and listened to the news, saw newspaper headlines, you probably thought that there were a far broader decline in the markets than what there actually was, because the S&P 500 is so widely quoted. But this was a situation where everything else actually did pretty well. So we saw bonds diversify those kind of the decreases. So it was a more of a traditional kind of risk off. You know, when you leave stocks, you go to bonds for safety. We also saw non-U.S. stocks holding up a lot better than U.S. stocks. A lot of that was as the U.S. dollar declined. A U.S. investor kind of benefits because their non-U.S. Investments go up further in value. So so that was a benefit as well. And so the result, if you look down in the table in the bottom right there for the quarter, was a pretty bad quarter if you were in U.S. Stocks of any kind, large or small, a little bit better in value, but everything else did pretty well. So diversification, you know, which we talk about a lot, for the first time in several quarters, really was important in this quarter. And I think you'll see when we look at the individual investment options, especially the pre-diversified, target retirement date funds, how important that diversification was in the. If there aren't any questions on that, I want to touch on one more thing before I turn it over to Ryan Fitzgerald. If we go two pages forward. So this is a page, and you know, every time that we have, you know, kind of market volatility and turbulence, it always feels like the worst it's ever been. and so, you know, we wanted to show in this chart that while it kind of felt like that again in kind of, you know, the March and April timeframe, if you look at the, so the blue bars here are the S&P 500 returns for a calendar year. So that's kind of what the returns were for that full year. The red dot is the maximum drawdown during that period. So from some point to kind of as far down as you know, we got from a peak in the markets, what was that drawdown? And so on the far right-hand side through, and this was around April 8th, that red dot was down almost 20%. So that's kind of the mid-February to April 8th timeframe. And, you know, lots of gloom clearly in the markets. And, you know, if you look across, though, to the left, there have actually been a number of cases where we've seen drawdowns that big, even though it felt very different to us. And so that just gives you a good view that, you know, while market volatility always feels like it's like, you know, worse than it's ever been before, that drop was really not that out of line with what we've seen in history. And, you know, interestingly, this this chart was as of April 8th. As of today, that blue bar is actually positive again. The S&P is actually up about almost 2%. So, you know, really interesting times for sure. But really, from our perspective, the message was diversification is really important. And I'll turn it around to kind of show how that translated into the funds.
Thanks, Kevin. Before we get there specifically for performance, a few housekeeping items. So this quarter, the 2020 fund, for the target retirement date fund, it was rolled into the retirement fund. That's a mechanical process that happens every 5 years. It's written into policy to just be automatic, and it's handled behind the scenes thanks to Vestwell and OTSN staff. So that you'll notice one less fund there this quarter than you did last. But other than that, everything is the same here, about the same allocations to the target retirement date suite and capital preservation. We did meet with State Street here at the state at the Treasury. I believe that was in March, along with a few staff as well. I think Caitlin, you were there, and Mr. Mann was there, maybe virtually, I think. And it was a good meeting with State Street. It's always nice to hear from them directly about, you know, philosophy, if anything has changed. They have a pretty comprehensive annual review process where they really go in depth on one specific topic. And this year it was the split between U.S. Small cap and U.S. large cap. Their thinking there is that early in a saver's life of saving, you can take the additional risk and have an overweight to small cap. And as you approach retirement, then it makes more sense to be in the safer large cap space. So that played into returns over the last few years, and I'll touch on that when it points out exactly. But if we flip forward two pages, we can go directly to performance, and this is quarter to date. Here, from the left-hand side, so the growth option, that's the S&P 500 index that represents the growth option for savers. You have one big outlier here, and that's the 1.8 from the State Street Target Retirement 2070 fund. That fund was recently launched, and so cash flows have really impacted that performance. We've included a footnote down there and spoken with them about it. You know, I'd like to say that was due to their terrific active management, but it is strictly a result of cash flows for it being a pretty small fund. And interestingly, that wasn't added into the 2070 fund until the end of the quarter. So, it's the underlying State Street fund now there so its track record will show a little bit higher return going forward. And as more quarters are added, it will look less and less. But that should be in line there with the rest of them going forward. It was a good relative quarter, particularly for all the funds across the State Street complex for the target retirement date funds. they outperform peers and, you know, the respective indices, you know, categorically from the 265 fund all the way through the income fund. So it was a good quarter there. The things that really helped it was an allocation to long bonds, an allocation, an overallocation to non-U.S. equity compared to peers. And the one detractor then was for the funds that were further away from retirement was the small cap bias for those ones. So all in, the diversification Kevin mentioned was a big driver of relative performance for the target retirement date funds. And it benefited State Street because they do have a little bit more of a pronounced tilt than others in the marketplace. We flip forward one page, and this is interesting. Very rarely will we see something so flat in terms of risk versus return for all of these funds, but it is worth noting that for the target retirement date funds across the board for the last year, up somewhere between 5.7 and 6.5%. So a very kind of flat capital markets line for the last year. State Street has performed in line with expectations and peers up until very close to retirement. Large cap bias, their allocation to treasury inflation protected securities instead of nominal bonds. Obviously, inflation's been on the minds of lots of folks, and then additional high yield exposure has been very good for their relative performance. So the 2030 fund, the 2025 fund, and the income fund have all really outperformed peers. And then the other thing I'd note on this page is just interesting. That growth option on the far left, so that's represented the red dot. That's the S&P 500 index. So just being in the S&P index over not only this past year, but the past 5 years has been off the chart good performance. So until this past quarter, additional diversification had not really been rewarded. And so it was a bit of a market flip from that standpoint. We flip forward then one page, we'll see a more typical looking risk return kind of profile. As you get closer to retirement, those 2030, 2025 and the income fund, you should see, in general, in absolute sense, less return than you should from the TRD funds that are much further away from retirement. The main thing that's led the lagging for any of the further away from retirement options for State Street, as we've mentioned a few times over the last several years, is that they have an allocation that's more tilted towards long bonds as opposed to aggregate. Bloomberg aggregate investment grade bonds, and they have additional diversification away from the S&P 500. So over the last 5 years, it's been a less rosy ride for State Street, but over the long term, they have some tilts and some biases we think will be rewarded. So it's a thoughtful process and one that we always like hearing about. That is it for my prepared remarks for this quarter, but we're happy to answer any type of investment-related questions, you know, not only on State Street, but, you know, anything at all.
Thank you very much, Ms. Backus, Ms. Damonin. Good? Okay. Certainly reassuring to see how well y'all are helping us do compared to our colleagues in other states, and Oregon savers should be very appreciative of that fact. So do we have anybody signed up for public comment, Ms. Daigle? No?
No, we don't have anyone for public comment today.
Cool. Mr. Mann, any comments before we wrap up for today?
Thank you, Treasurer. Just a couple things for me. One is noting that we are scheduled to meet in Salem for our next board meeting, which would be a change in venue for this board. And then Treasurer wanted to see if you wanted to return to board member reports. I think I may have jumped ahead.
Board
members, and I just
that
before
was
we close
entirely
out.
That was entirely my fault. Sorry. Thank you, Ms. Damonin, Ms. Backus. Anything else you'd like to add just in general for the good of the order?
I already mentioned my comment that I was kind of thinking of is just the market volatility and just kind of thinking about our savers who are new to the program. And that's kind of what's been on my mind recently. So that's all I had.
Yeah, I've been thinking about that a lot, and we've been having a lot of internal conversations about it. I'm very reassured, frankly, by some of the statistics we saw about how little
movement there is.
Movement. Thank you. That was the word I was looking for. My daughter's getting married on Sunday, and my brain is mush, as you can imagine, because I haven't been sleeping very much. So I apologize. There's been very little movement, and it looks like it's essentially identical to where we were a year ago. So that's very reassuring about the kinds of education that our savers have gotten over time. So that's good. Anything else, Ms. DeMona?
You know, I was just thinking, would we ever want to bring someone from BOLI to come talk to us about their experience just to develop a relationship, potentially, just so we're all kind of on the same page?
Yeah, that's a great idea. We'll talk about that internally and think about that for the August meeting. I appreciate you bringing up that idea. That's exactly the kind of thing we're looking for. So that's great. We can talk about that internally. Okay. All right. So next meeting's in August. I don't know if we have a firm date yet, but hopefully we do.
August 19th.
Thank you. August 19th. The next meeting is August 19th in Salem. We will continue to follow a newer version of our format, and we will let people know ahead of time whether there are specific things we want you to be thinking about. And in the meantime, of course, if you have specific things, as Ms. DeMorin just did, about ideas for future meetings, we'd really like to hear from you about them, because we want this board to be interesting and useful for you, just as we hope it's useful for our savers. Okay, team, anything else that we should be thinking about before we wrap for today?
No, I think we've covered our treasurer. I just want to note that it is 2:28. We managed to get in under 90 minutes.
I want to
thank presenters for kind of tightening up presentations and helping us make this efficient.
Yeah, having slides that are a little easier for us to read, having fewer slides, I think we still got all the core information that we needed, and I think gave us an opportunity to be a little bit more engaged. So thank you. Okay, cool. Then unless there's a reason I shouldn't, I'm going to adjourn the meeting. Okay,
sounds good.
We're adjourned. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Take care.
Happy wedding.